Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today we want to talk about the coming tax legislation. So the subject is taxes, and it's the latest of the major tax revisions of the last 30 years, actually since 1981-82 with Reagan. Part of the neoliberal economic policy. Tax cuts are a keystone of neoliberal economic policy. And it's all part of this great American tax shift that has been occurring since the 1980s. And what we're seeing coming here now, it's priority number one legislatively, now that the Obamacare ACA revision is on the back burner. Now at the front of the agenda is the tax cuts, and that's what's coming now, and that's what we're going to be talking about a little bit here today. Okay, we want to talk about a little bit of a background, because the legislation isn't fully baked yet, but it soon will be, and we will soon see all the details of it, probably by September, right? But let's look at this in a historical context a little bit. I think that's important, and that's what we're going to do today here. What are some of the key points that we want to emphasize as we look at this tax legislation that's coming and look at its historical background since 1981? Well, first of all, what we see in the last 30-some years, 35, 6 years here, is that consistent incentives for corporations to offshore jobs. Yes, you know, we actually provide tax incentives to move jobs offshore. This has been going on for a long time, ever since the early 1980s. So people are voting for politicians who vote to get their jobs shifted offshore here. How do they do that? Oh, there's all kinds of means, like the investment tax credit, the export-import bank subsidies, and a host of other depreciation and other rules here that make it, you know, an incentive for businesses to actually move jobs offshore, particularly manufacturing jobs. All right, what's another point? One another point of the last 30 years is that we have a shell game going on. What do we mean by a shell game? Well, every time we have a major tax reform bill, as they call it, part of it is reducing top tax rates, either corporate tax rates or individual personal income tax rates, reducing them or raising them, and inverting loopholes. In other words, if they raise the corporate tax rate because people are making complaints that the rich aren't paying enough, well, they just open up loopholes for the rich to offset those tax hikes, tax rate increases. Well, now we're looking at the opposite of that. Now they're going to be lowering tax rates for corporations. And by the way, they alternate between the shell game between corporate tax rates and personal income tax rates. Right now, the issue is lowering corporate tax rates, but they're going to allow an increase in the loopholes in, to offset the lower corporate tax rates. So you get this shifting between the higher and lower tax rates and increasing and reducing loopholes, you know, reverse policy here. And the net result is that taxes for corporations and the very rich just keep declining over the decades. Their total share contribution to total tax revenue declines. I mean, it's blatantly obvious with the corporate tax revenue share. It used to be like 23-24% of all federal government revenues, where corporate income tax, well, today that's about 6% of total revenues. So we got this shell game of lowering the tax rate and reducing the loopholes and then raising the tax rate and expanding the loopholes. And every time we have a major tax legislation, that shell game is played. And, of course, people can't see the visibility of the loopholes is not all that great because they're embedded in the legislation language. And people tend to see the tax rate. But that's the nominal tax rate, by the way. That's not really the effective tax rate, you see, because what matters is the effective tax rate. What are they actually paying is the question here. And that's a function of how broad are the loopholes, the exceptions. You know, you could have a 35% corporate tax rate, and they say, oh, that's the highest in the world. But they've got so many loopholes, the effective tax rate for U.S. multinational corporations is about 12%. Not 35, it's 12%. After all the loopholes and exceptions and exemptions come into play, they're only paying 12%. And what are they paying foreign governments? Are they paying foreign governments about 2 to 4%? And what are they paying state governments in the states in the U.S. in which there is a corporate income tax? They're paying about 2%. So the effective total overall tax rate for large corporations in the U.S. is really about 16 to 17%. It's not the 35 and 48% nominal rates that you hear people talk about when they're trying to sell. Let's give these corporations more money. All right, so that's one of the key points: the shell game between rates, nominal, real, and rates and loopholes. That's been going on for 35 years, right? As well as the progressive incentives for corporations to offshore investment and therefore jobs. Now, not just corporate tax rate. If you look at the U.S. tax system, there's like four major taxes. There's the personal income tax, about 40-45% of total government revenues. There's the payroll tax for Social Security, which today is about 40-45% as well. Back in the 1960s, it was only like 22%. So that's doubled. And then there's the corporate income tax, which has declined, and what's called the inheritance tax, which is just on like 0.2% of the wealthiest households in the U.S. Very, very few. But it brings in a lot of money because they have a lot of money. So that's the third element, the inheritance tax. The fourth element has to do with tariffs and excise taxes and miscellaneous other taxes. So the big tax rates are the corporate income tax, the personal income tax, and the payroll tax and the inheritance tax. That's the essence of the federal tax system. It's been that way since 1916, when they first began collecting income taxes. Okay. Another trend that we're seeing, particularly, is to ignore for decades now the prosecution of companies that fail to pay their foreign profits tax. You hear a lot of talk about how much these companies are holding offshore in their corporate subsidiaries and refusing to bring it back to pay, or refusing to pay the profits tax. When Obama got elected in 2008, he made a feeble effort to try to collect some of that, but he quickly backed off of that. How big is that? Well, it's probably between $2 and $3 trillion multinational corporations hold in their offshore tax shelters today, $2 to $3 trillion, mostly tech companies, banks, pharmaceutical companies, and other major multinational corporations. Okay, so what do I mean by the trend? Well, they're putting more of their money in their offshore subsidiaries as they become more global and refusing to pay taxes. And this issue came up in 2005 under George Bush, and a deal was struck. At that time, I think the total offshore cash hoard, tax-avoiding cash hoard, was about $1.3 trillion or something, a little over $1 trillion today. It's like two, three times that. Well, the deal struck in 2005 was bring that money back, and you only have to pay 5.25%. Apple, better than the 35%. So, you know, Apple did, and the others, some of the others did bring some of the money back. They were supposed to, per the law and the legislation, giving them the big tax rate, they were supposed to use it to invest in U.S. jobs and expand U.S. jobs in 2005. Well, they reinvested it, but it was to buy mergers, acquisitions by competitors and so forth. This was all reported in the media for about a month or so, but then it became so obvious what was going on, even the media, the business press, stopped reporting this by March 2005. But it was clear they were using all the money to buy up their competitors instead of creating jobs in the U.S. with it. But they got away with it. They brought about $700 billion back and only had to pay 5.25%. Well, as we'll see when we talk about the current legislation pending, we got the same thing going on right now, the same issue. Okay. We'll hold and talk about that. They're playing the same game. They're saying, bring some of it back. We'll give you a low tax rate if you bring some of it back. So it's called the repatriation tax bill, and it's going to be the same boondoggle. You know, if you let them get away with it in 2005, they did the same thing. They started parking some more of their profits offshore, and now they're playing the same game, these multinationals, these tech companies, so forth. One of the worst offenders, of course, is Apple. How much is Apple hoarding offshore now? $246 billion. Microsoft, $116 billion. They park it away in their subsidiaries instead of paying taxes on it here at home. Okay. Another trend here is what we call inversions. What are inversions? Inversions is this gimmick that came up under Obama, where companies, particularly pharma, big pharma companies and tech companies and consulting companies, simply move their headquarters on paper offshore, either to Ireland or to Luxembourg or places like that in Europe. Because their headquarters is offshore, they claim their taxation offshore, and they get pay far less taxes. And they get away from paying U.S. taxes, even though all their business does not change in the United States. It's all the same. You know, they don't change an iota of how they do business, what they sell, where they sell, what they manufacture. They just change on paper their headquarters. And by doing that, they get these huge tax breaks. Okay, so inversions are a trend. Avoiding foreign profit taxes is a major trend. This is continued. These are major trends here. And we'll talk about that as we talk about the proposals that are forthcoming here and how do they play into not just nominal tax rate changes, but how do they play in terms of loopholes? Because, again, there's the shell game that goes on, right? If we're going to lower corporate taxes, Congress is going to talk about, oh, we're going to close loopholes. And they'll pick a few token loopholes to close to make a big publicity effort about it. But the net result will be, even though they close some loopholes, the big corporate rate reduction, the net result will be less taxes paid by corporations and big investors. Right. And then a couple of years from now, we'll probably have a reversal of that. We'll say, oh, these nominal rates are too low. They're getting away with murder. Let's raise these rates. So they'll raise the rates and they'll say, see what we did. We raised the rates. We made these rich folks and these corporations pay more. But they'll open up the loopholes at the same time. So in net terms, effective tax rates they'll be continuing to pay less. Okay. Now, this tax legislation that's coming has a couple obstacles before it actually happens. One, as you know, taxes and revenues have something to do with U.S. deficits. And, of course, cumulative deficits constitute the U.S. federal debt, which is well over $19 trillion now. And the big run-up, by the way, in the debt has been since 2000, when we had these massive tax cuts under George Bush, continued under Obama, as I'll explain, and now escalating further under Trump. The government deficit and debt goes from $4 trillion in 2000 to the almost $20 trillion today. So in 16 years, you have a quintupling of the government deficits and debt. Well, what's behind that? They'll make you think it's spending on Social Security and profligate consumer spending and so forth, but that has nothing to really to do with it. It's really about tax cuts and increased spending on war and other a few other major policy changes, which I'll talk about. Okay, so taxes, this is important. Taxes are responsible for 60% of the deficits in debt. Taxes. It's not spending, it's taxes. And how much of taxes are responsible, tax cuts? Well, it's a mix between tax cuts constituting the 60% and low collection of tax revenues because of low economic growth. Now, we've had this historically low economic growth since 2008. We had the collapse in 2008 and 2009, which reduced tax revenues in a major way. But the recovery has been one-half to two-thirds of normal historically in the U.S. So government revenues have not been very significant tax revenues since then. That low collection of revenues is partly responsible as well for the situation that we face today in terms of deficits and debt. So 60%. The other 40% is from government spending. Okay, but what government spending? Well, we've spent about $6 trillion on foreign wars. The Pentagon spending is only part of government war spending. You see, the U.S. government tucks away the costs of war in various different agencies, not just in the Pentagon. The Energy Department pays for all the fuel for the military. You have the Atomic Energy Department. You have the Veterans Affairs, which is the post-war cost for vets, housing and education, and especially medical, right? All that goes up as well after wars. So the cost of wars continue for many years. We have the $6 trillion on spending from war. We also have over $600 billion we've been spending new since 2001 on Homeland Security, $60 billion a year at least. So, you know, that's like $700-800 billion for Homeland Security. That's added to this government debt that's gone from $4 trillion to $20 trillion. In 2005, we also passed a Part D Medicare prescription drug bill, but we didn't pass any way of funding that. So that comes out of taxes as well. And, of course, we know Part D prescription drugs, Medicare, is kind of a boondoggle for the big pharma companies, because the government can't negotiate any kind of discounts that's prohibited by the bill, and they get to charge, pharma companies get to charge whatever they want. And, of course, they've been ripping that off. So it's really a boondoggle here for the pharma companies. You know, it does provide some benefits to retirees, no doubt, but they didn't pass any taxes to pay for it, and it's all out of government direct funding. Okay, so there's a few other items here, too, you know, interest on the debt, and other government spending programs, but it's been mostly those items that constitute the 40% of the government deficits and debt. Okay, 40%. And now the 60% is tax cuts and slow growth, right? The tax cuts clearly for 30-some years now are an example of how the state, the government, Congress in this case, is engaging in fiscal policy state subsidization of corporate America. Just as I've been talking in previous weeks how the central bank and the monetary policy has now become subsidization of the banks and the financial system by providing zero rate loans and what's called quantitative easing bond buying. So what we've got since 2000 is this intensification going on of subsidization of the state, of the private sector. Okay? So this is very important development that's going on here in since 2001. Okay. I said there were objectives or obstacles that exist to the developments that we've been talking about, the tax legislation that's coming. Well, you know, they have to pay, have to pass a debt ceiling bill, has to be passed coming up here on October 1st. And then they got to pass a budget first coming up. And then there's the question of ACA Light. Right, the proposal here that they plan to resurrect to partially take away Obamacare, a massive transfer of $592 billion in tax cuts under original repeal of Obamacare, right? If which was, as I've said in previous shows, was always the real objective of Obamacare, of repealing Obamacare. Businesses, investors didn't like the 3.8% investment tax and the other taxes that partly paid for it. Think of Obamacare as an intra-capitalist transfer. They were taking money from certain sectors of capitalist investors and funneling it through the government as subsidies to the health insurers and the pharma, big pharma companies. And that's why it caused so much heartburn for the capitalist class or segments of it. They didn't like the idea of one segment subsidizing the other segment. And the Koch brothers and others, Prosperity for America, their organization, led the charge against Obamacare. And they certainly didn't like the fact that not only was the $592 billion being used to finance the subsidies for people to buy health care and then thus subsidizing pharma and health insurers. But they especially didn't like the fact that $800 billion of it was going not even to the insurance companies and the pharma companies, but going directly to Medicaid. And that's why you saw in the repeal here, repeal the $592 billion in tax cuts and pay for it by ending the subsidies to Medicaid. Okay, but as we all know, that thing did not pass. But they're not giving up. They're going to figure out some way to reduce some of. They won't be able to repeal it all, but they'll try to slip in provisions here, maybe in the tax bill, to get rid of some of those taxes that were imposed as part of ACA. We'll see. We'll see. We're just at the beginning of the whole process here. Now, when we say let's look at the historical perspective for tax policy evolution here in the U.S., what does that mean? Well, we started out in 1981-82 with Reagan tax cuts, which amounted at the time to $750 billion he proposed of tax cuts, mostly for investors and businesses and corporations. A good part of that got passed, not all of it. You know, that $750 billion was on a national GDP far less than we had in 2008. Obama only proposed the $787 billion in 2009, you know, a little bit more than Reagan, but on a U.S. economy and the GDP, that was at least two to three times the size of Reagan. But no one made a big stink about Reagan passing tax cuts of $750 billion, comparable to the stink they made when Obama tried to pass even more. And, you know, he voluntarily scaled it down at the time in 2009. Well, that was a big neoliberal tax move here under Reagan in 1981-82. And at the same time, he increased defense spending significantly. You know, he built a 600-ship Navy and all of the kinds of defense spending increase. That's a hallmark of neoliberalism, right? Corporate tax cuts and defense spending increases. Now, obviously, if you cut taxes and increase defense spending, what that means is that you're going to increase your deficits and therefore your debt. And that's exactly what happened under Reagan. We had a ballooning of budget deficits for the first time and the beginning of the escalation of the total federal government U.S. debt. So these policies, tax fiscal policies of tax cuts for investors and increasing of defense spending results in big-time deficits. Now, under Reagan, the argument was, there were two arguments of how these deficits would be offset. One argument was that, well, we're going to cut Social Security, and we're going to cut social spending and so forth, and that will offset some of the deficits from the tax cuts. The other argument was that, this is supply-side economics, meaning that if you cut tax rates and taxes, you will generate so much economic activity and growth that it will bring you more tax revenues as a result. Well, this was just economic ideology. It was nonsense back then, and it's nonsense today, but it's been around, this whole notion, which is just a justification for cutting taxes for corporations and wealthy folks. It has nothing to do with reality and economics, but it sure sounds like economics. And, you know, these idiots in Congress who know better, and those ignoramuses who don't know better, and that's a big proportion there now in Congress, you know, they keep pushing this nonsense of supply side. Cut taxes and you increase tax revenues. Oxymoron. You know, doesn't work. Historically, it doesn't work. Theoretically, it's nonsense. But historically, there's no proof of it working. In fact, just the opposite. So the whole Reagan policy was predicated on generating more economic activity to bring in more revenue and cutting social spending to offset the defense increase spending and the corporate and investor tax cuts. Didn't work. Completely did not work. And we were running these huge deficits by mid-1980s. And they got together. Even Reagan recognized it by 1986. Well, by 1986, he wasn't really running the government anymore. It was James Baker and a few others. They got together in the so-called tax reform. And the Democrats cooperated, and they came out with some token loophole closings and reducing some of the deficit spending on defense and reducing some of the taxes, the tax cuts, rather, and as a way to try to slow down these huge deficits and debt run-up. They slowed it down, but that's all they did. They didn't really deal with it. By the way, another indicator of neoliberal tax policy is and tax cutting for the rich is by reducing the number of tax brackets, not just reducing the rate the nominal rate, but the brackets, how many levels of payment, you know, like there's a 10% certain income, up to a certain income level, everyone pay 10%, up to another income level, they'll pay 15, another they'll pay 20, et cetera. The fewer brackets you have, the better deal it is for the very rich. So that's always an indicator of neoliberal tax programs, and Reagan reduced the brackets, as Trump is proposing to do, and as George W. Bush did back in 2001, which we'll talk about still. So 1986 was a kind of a threshold where they shored up the big generous tax cuts to some extent, but only temporarily and only to some extent. Then we had the recession in 1990-91 as a result of the collapse of the junk bond market and the savings and loan in the U.S., savings and loan debacle in the U.S. in the late 80s. And the government directly, Congress, had to bail out the SNLs, cost $300 billion, which was a large sum at the time. And they needed to raise taxes also to some extent. And George H.W. Bush, Daddy Bush, who had run on a program in 1988 for president saying, no new taxes, quote, read my lips. You know, it ended up that he agreed to raising taxes. Ah, but you know what? He raised the tax bracket. Not for the very top level, he raised it for the level below them. In other words, the upper middle class, not the real, you know, big investors, not the multimillionaires and billionaires, but the folks who are making, you know, 100,000 plus. So he raised their tax rates, but he didn't raise it for his buddies, because he's certainly in that 1%. that didn't do him much good when he ran in 1992. And, of course, he had an opposition there. And Ross Perot, billionaire from Texas, who also ran, by the way, ran against this proposed expansion of North American Free Trade Agreement to include Mexico at the time. You see, NAFTA begins in 1988 under Reagan. In Canada is added. That was the dress rehearsal. But the biggie was adding Mexico to NAFTA. And that big push came under Daddy Bush and was implemented then under Clinton, Bill Clinton. Right. So read my lips, a tax hike, of a restoring of the tax cuts of Reagan to some extent, to pay for the SNL bailout, right? And, of course, that cost him his election. Perot and Read My Lips were two reasons why Daddy Bush did not win in 92. So what did Bill Clinton do? Well, Bill Clinton comes in, and he not only – he does a whole number of things, passes NAFTA, passes World Trade Organization, you know, free trade really accelerates under him, devastating results. He begins this H-1B visas program, accelerates that for his tech buddies out in California, who are now aligning themselves with the Democratic Party, making big contributions. And he allows the tech companies to bring in a lot of foreign skilled workers on H-1B visas and L-1, L-2 visas. By the time he leaves office, there are like 500, hundreds of thousands a year coming in from offshore. And they come in, and a lot of them then apply for citizenship and stay. Well, you know, millions and millions of skilled workers since 1995, foreign skilled workers have come into the U.S. and taken jobs that American students should have gotten. And skilled people should have gotten skilled jobs. And that OH-1B system and O-1-2 system pretty much destroyed any internal corporate training programs. Tech companies in the 80s used to train their skill base. So people were coming along, you know, they'd have a good flow of skilled people to take jobs that they needed. Well, they ended all that. They ended all that when they got the H-1B, L-1-2 visa boondoggle here from Bill Clinton. And we've had that problem ever since. If you look at the recession of 2001 to 2005, the tech industry cut about 500,000 jobs, laid off 500,000 people in the U.S. It was the tech bust of 2001. However, during that same period, they brought in 500,000 foreign workers, skilled workers, into the industry. So they were laying off people here and hiring people from offshore. It's really a travesty when you think about it, what's been going on. I'm emphasizing this because I'll have a few comments at the end of the show on Trump's announcement this past week that relates to H-1Bs here and immigration. Okay, so what else did, in 1997, Bill Clinton do? Well, he opened up new loopholes here, not only in this offshoring thing and for the tech companies, but and he also provided dividend cuts and inheritance tax cuts and capital gains tax cuts for investors. They weren't all that generous as they would be under George W. Bush, but he created the template, you see, for that. And he sweetened the pot a little bit to get it through Congress by providing education credits and marriage credits, you see. That's what the Democrats will do. They'll throw a few crumbs in their tax bills to the middle class and the working class, and they'll give the, you know, the big lion's share of the tax cut to the 1%, whereas the Republicans, they won't give anything to the middle class. And in fact, as we'll see, we'll be taking away from the middle class in the Trump bill and giving even greater tax benefits to their wealthy friends. All right, so we get to 2001 and 3, and we get to George W. Bush, and we get a huge tax bill here. 2001, 2002, 2003 tax bills every year, which they call job creation bills. But by the way, there is no evidence empirically whatsoever that business tax cuts create jobs. But that's another ideological lie that they keep pushing here. Business tax cuts create jobs in order to sell it. $3.7 trillion. $3.7 trillion. The most massive tax cuts since the 1920s, probably, under George W. Bush. And the core of that were tax cuts for investors, personal income tax cuts, you see. This was a period of personal income tax cuts, not corporate tax cuts. And we had this massive investor tax cutting going on to the tune of $3.7 trillion. And the Tax Foundation and other independent sources identify that more than 80% of this went to the wealthiest 10% households in the U.S., and most of that to the 1% households in the U.S. That was George W. Bush between 2001 and 2004. After 2004, we started getting industry-specific tax cuts, like oil and energy and so forth. And we had, as I mentioned it previously, this boondoggle of the repatriation tax for offshore multinational corporations. Instead of paying 35%, they would pay 5.25% to bring some of their money back. That was under George W. Bush. And then the 2008 crash occurred, and Bush added another $180 billion tax cut at the beginning to try to stimulate consumption in this case, but it didn't have any effect. It was just minuscule compared to the crash that was going on. Obama comes into office in 2009, and his bill, his Recovery Act of $787 billion, included about $300 billion in tax cuts, most of that going to businesses, small businesses, big businesses, and so forth, very little to consumers. By the way, when that bill was being developed in the Congress, in the House, the House of Representatives had added $150 billion more in consumer household tax cuts. You know, that tax bill of that recovery bill of $787 billion, of which $300 billion was tax cuts, was supposed to be $450 billion in tax cuts, $150 billion in consumer household tax cuts. But Obama, on the advice of Larry Summers, cut that out. Yeah, he actually reduced the amount of tax cuts going to households by about $150 billion. Larry Summers said, we can't absorb that much tax cut. Yeah, Larry Summers, who before that was working for the big bankers. Okay. All right, so we end up with only $300 billion in that $787 billion recovery program. $300 billion more was handouts by Obama to the states. The states were supposed to spend it on creating jobs, but they hoarded most of it. They sat on most of it, so it didn't get into the economy much. Then there was supposed to be $100 billion on infrastructure, long-term infrastructure spending. They called it shovel-ready infrastructure, but they couldn't find their shovels, and it had very little effect. So the Obama recovery bill, $787 billion, had minimal effect. And that's why the recovery was so slow and so hesitating. And actually, we fell into a double-dip recession in 2011-12, although the GDP indicator does not fully reveal that. All right, so that's Obama in 2009. The economy was beginning to slip in 2010. And what did Obama do at the end of 2010? Well, he extended the Bush tax cuts for two more years. They were supposed to expire in 2010. That cost another $450 billion in Bush tax cuts and extensions. And he proposed and Congress passed an additional $803 billion in tax cuts. So when the economy did not really recover and started faltering, he passed even more tax cuts instead of spending cuts. Well, there was $55 billion in extending of unemployment insurance, but $55 billion for the whole population and $800 billion for businesses and corporations, plus the $450 billion of the Bush tax cuts extensions, really reveals that this continuity of policy of relying both on tax cuts, mostly for investors and corporations, to try to stimulate the economy since Reagan under neoliberalism, and as I've said in previous weeks, the other major policy offensive was monetary policy by the central bank, provide zero interest rates, free money to the bankers, and buy up the bad debts, QE, quantitative easing, that they had made from bad deals prior to that. That's what the whole strategy is. Free money, we'll buy your bad debts, and we'll give you tax cuts, and we'll give you subsidies. And the rest of us, we'll throw you a few crumbs here, maybe, a little bit of tax cut credit here or there, but not very much, you see. You bail out the capitalists, particularly the bankers and the big corporations, and you hope that they share some of that bailout with the rest of the economy and country. The problem is that they don't. They haven't. What have I been saying for weeks now? What do they do with all that subsidy, monetary and fiscal? Well, they either sit on it, they hoard it, or they funnel it into financial assets, market stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, whatever, worldwide, or they send it offshore to invest in expansion of infrastructure and businesses and corporations offshore, because remember, they get a big tax cut by investing offshore. And that's where all the money goes. The trillions and trillions of dollars is not going any longer where it's supposed to really stimulate the real economy. That's neoliberalism in the 21st century. Okay, so we haven't finished here with this little historical overview of major tax legislation, its content and its form. We're up to 2012. Obama extends the Bush tax cuts for 2 years, from 2010 to 12. Okay, they expired. They're set to expire in 2012. And what happens at the end of 2012? It was called the fiscal cliff. If we don't extend these Bush tax cuts, the sky's going to fall. The economy, which is already weak, and as I said earlier, technically was slipping into a double-dip recession. The big media and everything, we got to have more money here for corporations and investors. So Obama agreed to extend in 2013, January, agreed to extend the Bush tax cuts for another 10 years at a cost of $5 trillion. Obama passed more and enabled more tax cuts for wealthy households and corporations than even Bush. Bush's original $3.7 trillion, and then the repatriation and industry bills and $180 billion when the collapse began, maybe $4.5 trillion. Well, Obama, we're looking at $300 billion in 2009, $800 billion in 2010, $450 more billion between 2010 and 12. That's a $1.5 trillion. And then we have a $5 trillion extension. So it's $6.5 trillion in tax cuts under Obama, $4.5 trillion under Bush. That's $11 trillion since 2000 in tax cuts, mostly for investors and corporations, $11 trillion. Remember, we go from $4 trillion to $20 trillion in the debt. The U.S. government debt, that's like $16 trillion. Well, $11 trillion of that is tax cuts. And that's not counting slow tax revenue collection because of the weak recovery. So, maybe $15, $12, $13, $14 trillion of that $15 trillion addition into debt is really, directly traceable to these tax cuts. And the rest, the rest is the $6 trillion in war spending for the Middle East over and above the Pentagon, right? They call it OCO, I forget exactly what OCO is, but that's what funds the direct war spending in Afghanistan and then Iran on top of that. And then, you throw in a few miscellaneous things, the boondoggle to the big pharma companies, Part D Medicare, right, Homeland Security, interest on the debt, and so forth. And there's your $20 trillion federal government debt. It's not rocket science to figure it out. It's all there. So now we're approaching another big tax boondoggle. That's where we are at the moment. And while the dimensions are not totally clear, what we're talking about here, there are some outlines. We can see some things. What's going to be coming. Probably we'll see a little more clarification in September, but certainly after October 1st, and they signed the debt increase bill, the debt extension, which will be signed, no doubt. They may come up with a government budget, but if they don't come up with a government budget, because they haven't defined the tax cuts, I suspect they'll just keep running the government as they have had without final total budget conclusion here in October. And so in October is when we're going to see the latest tax proposals clarified even further. And what will we see, right? Well, first of all, Trump and Ryan, it's a Trump-Ryan bill, Paul Ryan, he's the super conservative there, the Koch brothers front man in the House of Representatives in charge of tax policy. And by the way, they are there's a group of six now who are quietly, secretly writing up this tax bill. It's Ryan in the House and the head of the Ways and Means Committee. It's McConnell in the Senate and the head of the Finance Committee in the Senate. It's Steve Mnuchin, who is the Treasury Secretary, former Goldman Sachs senior manager. That's the group of six who are working this out, you see, in secret here. And we'll see this in October. But, you know, some things are being leaked, being talked about. And what are they, right? Well, Trump has proposed reducing the nominal rate from 35 to 15%. 15%. Well, you can imagine what the effective rate will be for corporations if the nominal rate is reduced from 35 to 15 and they're only really paying 16, 17% effective rate now under a 35% nominal rate. That's about half of the 35% nominal rate. So, you know, they'll end up paying about 8%, 7, 8% effective rate if this Trump bill goes through. And the 6% total revenue from corporate income taxes now will probably be about 3%. Another provision that's apparent here is end the offshore taxing of U.S. corporations altogether. They call this the territorial tax, right? End the territorial tax, saying, oh, U.S. are the only ones that pay a domestic corporate tax and a foreign corporate tax to the U.S. government, although they're not collecting the foreign. Mm-hmm. Foreign profits tax is just on paper, but they want to get rid of it altogether. Mm-hmm. And the tech companies are really pushing hard on this because, you know, as I said, Apple has $246 billion offshore, Microsoft $116 billion, huge amounts of hoards offshore that they're not paying taxes on. You know, they want to be free to do whatever they want with that. and there's talk about, oh, well, they'll have to pay a 10% repatriation. You know, remember, there's 5.25% back in 2005. Okay, now talk is 10% to bring the money back. Well, we'll see. The problem with this is if you end offshore taxation of U.S. corporations, you're going to open a floodgate for tax inversion loopholes. Inversions, remember? Inversions, pharma companies. Tech companies, they move their main headquarters offshore to avoid taxation, right? Well, if you eliminate all offshore taxation, it's going to open the floodgates. You're going to have all these U.S. corporations taking advantage of inversions and moving their headquarters offshore in order not to pay taxes in the U.S. Well, they're saying we have to do something about inversions. Don't bet on it. You know, the pharmaceutical companies are the biggest lobbyists in the U.S. government. Yeah, they're bigger than defense companies. They spend more than defense companies, right? You think with elections coming up in 2018 that they're going to really close the inversions loophole? I doubt it. Now, it appears here as of last week that making up some of the loss of tax revenue from these tax cuts by implementing a border tax on imports into the U.S. that Trump had proposed, right, is dead. Mm-hmm. That was supposed to pay for some of the corporate tax cutting from 35 to 15%. Well, if there's no border tax cuts to pay for it, how are they going to pay for that big 35 to 15% tax rate reduction? Well, I'll tell you how they're going to do it. They're going to take it out of the hide of the middle class. Right. They're going to eliminate historic deductions for itemization of your tax bill. You know, you can middle class folks, and by middle class, I mean, you know, people making households making maybe 80,000 to 200,000. You're going to lose your state and local government tax deduction, which is significant. They may eliminate some of the mortgage deduction. Mm-hmm. They will end the alternative minimum tax altogether, which benefits the very rich. That's being proposed. They're talking about reducing medical cost deduction. You know, if you have medical costs over significantly over your adjusted income tax, what you pay your taxes on, your adjusted income, you can reduce your taxes by these excess medical costs, right? These are the biggies. They're going to go after it, these deductions. Okay. And not only that, they'll go after energy credits for sure. And then they're going to go after education credits. So that's what they're going to make the middle class pay now that there's no border tax to offset the 35 to 15% tax reductions. Okay. They're even talking now that that might not be enough. And they're talking about going after cutting Social Security and Medicare. So watch it. Watch it. This is the big money deal. You know, ACA was a dress rehearsal, small dress rehearsal to what's really going on. Okay. Cutting taxes has always been the number one goal, and protecting free trade has always been the number one goal of big business in the United States. And you can see this very obviously now in this tax legislation. This is the real fight. Okay. And we're going to be watching this very closely in the weeks to come, and we'll have other shows on this. I just want to say something in closing about the events of the past week here, Trump's immigration order here, where he's cutting legal immigration by half, legal immigration, right? In other words, the unskilled. He's going to cut the unskilled by 500,000 people. Ah, but he says nothing about reducing skilled. In other words, the H-1B, L-1-2 visa folks and those folks coming in, buying their way into fast-track citizenship in the U.S. by bringing $500,000, folks from Asia, right, buying up real estate in the United States and homes and so forth, right? West Coast, big crisis going on of influx of H-1B from Asia, particularly from India, tech folks. Taking the jobs at lower pay they would pay for technical skilled U.S. workers, driving up home prices in the process, and driving up rents that follow the home prices. Now, this is Trump's America First. Yeah, well, we'll placate the big tech companies here, and increase the number of our skilled workers while they cut the number of unskilled, right? The other interesting development in the past week was an advisory committee to the Treasury, made up of investors and other finance capitalists, have been warning that corporate debt in the U.S. and leveraging of corporate debt is getting out of control and raises the possibility of a serious financial correction at some point. And that's what's going on here in the warnings going on, that the bond interest rates are so low and margin debt is escalating and bank lending to investors is becoming easier and easier. And as a result, we have this massive debt that's being accumulated on the business side, leveraging going on, leverage loans, crowdfunding, junk bonds, and so forth. So they're even indicating that we better watch what's going on here because we may be approaching another financial crisis if we're not careful. Interesting that the experts from the class, finance capitalists, are warning the government and the Treasury that this is happening. Okay. Next week, we will look at the anniversary of the Greek debt here after 2 years since it's 2 years ago, it's third major deal, debt deal here in exploitation. So we'll look at that next week. And tune in for a subsequent week where we're going to look at the tax bill and other legislation. That's right. Alternative.